History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And no, they don't have to go untold. Maybe you've had the chance to ask a few questions and you've experienced what I have over and over again, that when we take a little time to listen, we never ever regret it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. Of course, we want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. We're always educated, we're always entertained, and it really can be quite inspiring to listen to these memories from our men and women in uniform. In our last episode, we got to hear from a Silver Star recipient from the Vietnam War who has written about some of his experiences in a new book called First Shot, which we have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we heard the first part of his story last week, there was a small world detour involving a previous guest on the show that we took. And as a result, we didn't have time to get into his experience with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. So we're going to hear about that today, not to mention more about the book and why he wrote it, and also his connection to a former U.S. president. If you didn't get to hear last week's episode, you can pull it up anytime at hometownheroesradio.com. But to get you caught up a little bit, we're going to hear just a little context to set things up. Greg Schiffbauer served with MAC V SOG, Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observation Group. And he knew his covert operations there, often geared toward rescuing prisoners of war or downed pilots, were something he was not allowed to talk about.
You know, we were told, you know, we're not going to get recognition, we're not going to get rewarded, nobody's going to know about what we're doing and stuff. And at that time, I think, yeah, well, this is what we're studying. We're training at these camps that the agency runs. You know, I'm just saying, well, that's just stuff you don't talk about. Going to war was quite a bit different. And yes, I was scared. There's no question about it. I was afraid for my wife finding out if something happened to me. I don't know when I heard about it or read about it, but it's published someplace that 100% of MAC VSOG volunteers were either killed in action or wounded in action. Had I known that, I'm sure I would never have agreed to do what I did. But I worked with the best trained people and professional soldiers. I know it was my duty to take care of them, but they took care of me. They did their best to keep me out of harm's way. A few times my NCOIC would yell at me, get the hell, sit down, get down, don't stand up, and, you know, stay back. Sometimes you can't do that when you see people fighting for their lives. And you just, you know, you make decisions to do things that if you've sat and thought about it for any length of time, you might not do. I got kidded. I don't know what deployment it was on, that I held two records in Vietnam, one for crying and one for vomiting. It was a miserable place. My wife's an RN, and she knew I had things on my mind, and she told me, you know, you need to talk about it. When I'd see guys in the military and guys that had been to Vietnam wearing hats and this and that, you know, I'd thank them for their service and we'd start talking. You know, I might say, well, yeah, I was attached to MAC VSOG and what did you do? Well, they knew I wasn't going to talk about it much, but I just started loosening up and started loosening up. Then I went in and researched and see what we could talk about. So much of it's redacted. You just need to be careful. And the more my wife found out, the more she tried to get me to talk about it because she thought it might relieve some of my nightmares, some of my temper problems, because there were things that bothered me. And it did. So when you start hanging around military people, sometimes you just talk about stuff. Never talked about anything that I don't think I shouldn't have, maybe some of the things, but not where at, and naturally none of the people involved. But that's kind of what got me to write a book, too. That was the duty. And even to today, so much of it's classified that, you've got to work around that and make sure that everything goes through a you know, a publication audit for security review. I found a thing on MacVSog that was written up, and half of it's redacted. I mean, you skip from one word to the next paragraph sometimes. And it's just, you know, I don't know how much of that will become unclassified. It doesn't really matter to me. I don't care about the awards. I don't care about anything other than the fact we did our best to bring people home.
And you mentioned, you know, awards, and I've interviewed Medal of Honor recipients and guys who got the Distinguished Service Cross and the Air Force Cross, Navy Cross. I understand you're a recipient of a medal that's next in line there. That my grandfather received in World War II, the Silver Star. Can you tell us about what made you part of that very exclusive club?
Well, my NCO, I see, is the one that nominated me for it, and he was killed in action. His next in command is the one that sent everything through, and it was for a mission that I really can't talk about because someplace we weren't supposed to be, but one of my men stood up to fire at a enemy helicopter that was attacking us as we were trying to move troops out. And not even, you don't think in the field sometimes very well. And it's just that I got a man down out of fire and got up, took a sniper out of the tree, and then turned around and unloaded into the helicopter that was attacking our men while they were all hiding. I was lucky I made it away. That's all I know.
Well, it sounds like it. And again, I wasn't there, and I'm just listening to you and trying to picture it. It sounds like in that moment, you decided that you were going to put yourself in more danger to potentially save the lives of the guys with you, and it sounds like that's what happened.
Yeah, that's basically what I did.
Have you ever relived that moment and thought about why or what you'd do differently?
Yeah, you relive moments like that, like, you know, what the hell's wrong with you type of thing. But in those moments, common sense isn't always the right thing. You know, I've met Medal of Honor recipients. I know three of them pretty well. It's amazing what somebody will do to save somebody without even thinking about it. You know, I think of people like David Bellavia in Iraq. They do amazing things. I mean, there's corpsmen out there that have received the Medal of Honor. You know, these guys aren't even armed.
But they're in just as much danger, if not more so. Well, I hope that people are going to order this book and read all about it. You mentioned that the foreword of your book was written by someone whose name some of our listeners might recognize, but you can explain the connections that make his name well-known and also the connection to you.
Well, yeah, George Patton Waters. He's the grandson of General George Patton II, who the World War II general that pretty much everybody knows his name. But his father was also General John Waters, who had a very distinctive career of his own. Matter of fact, he was a POW.
And we explored some of that last week. The foreword for Greg Schiffbauer's book, First Shot, is written by Waters' son, who goes by Pat. And he starts, America has a rich history of special operations going back to the Jesse Scouts, irregular Union soldiers who operated behind Confederate lines during the Civil War. And, of course, during World War II, commandos with the Office of Strategic Services won fame for their legendary missions and earned the great respect and admiration of my grandfather, General George S. Patton, Jr. He continues, many special operations during the Vietnam War remain secret to some extent, yet some have come to light. For years, Greg had to conceal his work from everyone, including his dear wife, Maggie. He told cover stories about extended training in Panama or mundane tasks that his superiors ordered, but it was never the truth. On August 22, 2003, Greg and his comrades of MACV SOG were awarded the Presidential Unit Citation for extraordinary heroism in military operations against an armed enemy. The citation reads in part, "The Studies and Observation Group is cited for extraordinary heroism, great combat achievement, and unwavering fidelity while executing unheralded top-secret missions deep behind enemy lines across Southeast Asia." The citation continues, "Pursued by human trackers and even bloodhounds, these small teams outmaneuvered, outfought, and outran their numerically superior foe to uncover key enemy facilities, rescue downed pilots, plant wiretaps, mines, and electronic sensors, and inflict casualties all out of proportion to their own losses." Again, that is from Greg Schiffbauer's new book, First Shot, and the foreword written by the grandson of General George S. Patton, Jr.
I met him through a friend of ours who's an entertainer in Las Vegas and has been for a long time. That's Dandino Malacorti. And he and his wife were at a deal that I was at, and he came over to me and handed me a George Patton challenge coin. And I looked at it and I said, this is amazing. Where'd you get that? And he said, well, his grandson is passing this out to you for what you've done. So I made it my goal in life to meet this man. And last summer, my wife and our youngest son and I were on a road trip, and we stopped in Charleston, South Carolina, and met George Patton Waters and his wife, Martha. And they're just wonderful people. And we enjoyed our time with them, had dinner with them, and talked to them for quite a while. And it was so nice to meet somebody like that. The military makes real strange bedfellows. You know what I mean? You meet people that are amazing in the most unusual situations. I've met 3 Medal of Honor recipients, David Bellavia, General Jim Livingston, and Doc Ballard. Don Ballard. Yeah, Donald Ballard. Yeah. And these people are so humble. I mean, they're just very humble people. And like some of us, they're lucky to still be alive.
And that's what I was just going to propose, that when you meet someone who's done unimaginable things to save the lives of others, and you see that humility, isn't there a direct correlation to gratitude? Isn't the humility a byproduct of the gratitude someone feels when they know they easily couldn't be here or shouldn't be here? And I think I'm picking up on a hint of that in you and your perspective as well.
Well, I'm very grateful I'm here. There's no question about it. I don't really think about anything that I did. I think about what the men that served under me did, especially the ones that didn't come home. And, a lot of people in the military are told to do things that they normally would never do. And it's sort of a brotherhood. And whether they do good or whether they do bad, because we've had our share of foul play in the military, but when you find people like Medal of Honor recipients that are as humble as can be, and if they weren't forced into being out talking and doing their thing, you'd probably never know they were Medal of Honor recipients. But the Medal of Honor Society keeps them busy, and it's not even a governmental thing. Because it provides strength. I had a Medal of Honor recipient come and talk to our group a couple years ago. It was David Bellavia. And I invited all the junior ROTC people that I could get out of the valley to come to that. And it was $100 reception, and invited them all to come free along with their advisors. And David spent 80% of his time talking to these youngsters. And that was so impressive to me. You know, these people paid $100 to come to this thing and meet him and stuff. And he spent so much time with these kids. You could just see, they put that medal around their neck or take it off and put it around the kid's neck. And the inspiration is magnetic. It's just, you know. Doc Ballard was here in town, and we were at the Mission Barbecue, which has hundreds, 148 different venues, I think. They have one, and when we were in Washington, D.C. for the Honor Flight, we were fed by one of them. But he was there at that. I don't know. I mean, the place was pretty full. At noon, they play the national anthem, and everybody sings. I don't think there was one person in there that didn't come over to Doc Ballard and thank him, shake his hand. Most of them wanted a picture with him, which he gladly did. He put his medal around his neck. And it's amazing. It's just amazing. If you've been in battle, in any type of battle, and not even in the front line, but if you've just been deployed to a debat, you understand the camaraderie. You understand that there are people that are real heroes in this world. These guys stand out. They stand out above everybody. Went to a Chicago Cub baseball game years ago. We were back in Illinois, and we went to a Cub game, and they honored the men. There were 103, I think, Medal of Honor recipients at that game. The standing ovation, if they hadn't have started the game, they'd still be standing up there giving them. It made you cry. Mm-hmm. If you've been in battle, you've cried. And in most cases, you never stop crying.
I know many of you listening right now can identify with those words from Greg Schiffbauer, author of the book First Shot. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, his powerful experience with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. Not just visiting memorials in Washington, D.C., but seeing how he and his fellow veterans were treated. And before we're done, his special connection to a former president. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy, and when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank, so the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing our conversation with Silver Star recipient Greg Schiffbauer, author of the book First Shot, about his service with MACV-SOG in Southeast Asia. We connected with Greg through Honor Flight Southern Nevada, part of the National Honor Flight Network. If you haven't connected with an Honor Flight group near you yet, now would be a good time. You can volunteer or, if able, donate to the cause. This coming Tuesday is Giving Tuesday, and you won't find a better cause. Greg Schiffbauer's journey to Washington, D.C. and back is something he will never forget.
Honor Flight is incredible. From the time you leave the airport and everybody stands and applauds and this and that, and they have an honor guard, you get on the plane, you land. We landed at Baltimore, and when we got off the plane, there were hundreds of people standing there applauding and stuff with signs. I was in a wheelchair and I got out to walk because I didn't want to be in a wheelchair. And some young boy reached out to me and gave me a star cut out of an American flag. And he said, "Thank you for your service." And I said, "Well, thank you." And he said, "May I hug you?" And I said, "Of course, as long as I can hug you too." And on the way to hug him, I'm just thinking, what am I going to do after we hug? Give him a high five, tell him thanks. The lady next to him said he lost his father in Afghanistan. If I had had that star that was given, that silver star that I got, I'd have pinned it on him. I mean, there's moments like that are incredible. That started the whole weekend for me. So I started crying when we got off the plane. And, you know, Honor Flight is for everybody. It's not just for people who've been in a war. It's for everybody that's ever put a uniform on. I don't care if it's men or women or whoever it is. But, you know, you go and you're honored every place you go. You go out to dinner. We went to a VFW club that the dinner was served by Mission Barbecue. Yeah. And it was just amazing. They thanked us. They did all these things. And I went in to thank the commander of this VFW club before as we were leaving. Everybody was going out to the bus and stuff like that. And I walked into the bar area, and he was sitting at a table, and behind him there was just a wall of badges of people. And I looked it over and I said, You're missing a badge on there." And he said, "What is it?" I said, "You don't have MACV SOG up there." And he knew what it was. And he said, "No, we don't have anybody from MACV SOG come in here." And I said, "I'll tell you what, when I get home, I'll send you mine." And I did, and got a very nice thank you for it and everything. But, you know, it starts there, and then you're at the hotel, and most of the people are down at the bar. I don't drink, had throat cancer, so I don't drink or anything like that, but I sat in a bar, I bought a lot of drinks for people, and we sat around and told war stories and stuff. Not all these people had been in the war, but it didn't matter. And we talked and had a good time. The next morning you get up and you start going to the different monuments and memorials and stuff like that. And, you know, there's things that most of this trip, there were five Korean War veterans and the rest of them were Vietnam War veterans. We started at the World War II Memorial and, you know, went all around that. They came out and sang the national anthem. You know, we were all lined up, and most of us in our wheelchairs. And we toured that. We went from that to the Korean Veterans Memorial. And then we went to the Vietnam Memorial. And I was given the choice of presenting the wreath at the Vietnam Memorial or at Arlington National Cemetery. And I said, "Well, I'd rather do it at the memorial, at Vietnam Memorial." So another one of our veterans and I walked the reef down. And, I mean, there were hundreds of people there, you know, and getting names off the wall, taking pictures. And it was like the Red Sea was parted. They just stepped back as we walked down with this reef. And we placed it at the Vietnam Memorial Roost and stepped back and saluted it. Then people started coming up and talking to us, you know. "Is there a name you're looking for?" They have people there that help you find names. They have a book of all the names on that wall. I didn't even want to look. But my best, the guy that was there from my unit in Anthem, found his buddy's name on the wall. And he was a helicopter mechanic and crewman, as my friend was. And he was killed in Vietnam, and he found this thing. And it's funny that the Channel 5 News recorded the whole thing. They went about contacting a gal. They put it on the TV, and a gal contacted him, says, "That's my mother or somebody's, you know, father that was on the wall. So they contacted them and got them the daughter of the person that was killed in Vietnam. They brought him here along with some of the family to meet this guy. And I mean, this turned into a big deal. They've done a 45-minute tribute to that honor flight that we were on. I don't know if you've seen or not, but Channel 5 did that. And, you know, Ken had no idea they were going to do that when he came to his house and they videoed the whole thing. And he was on it all, you know, and it was just amazing. And after that, you know, we went to other war memorials. We went to the Air Force, the Marine place. But we went to just wonderful places and people just like the ocean spread when we came in. People stepped out of the way because they knew what we were to let us see the things. We went to Arlington National Cemetery and I looked at Audie Murphy's tombstone there and I, you know, thought of that. One of my favorite movies when I was a kid, you know. We went to the Unknown Soldier and I think it was four of our guys did the reef at the Unknown Soldier. These times are just filled with memories. And, you know, it's good to go through it because if you have demons, and a lot of people do, this helps relieve some of that pressure. You know, there's too many suicides from war veterans, too many. It's good to be able to get out and get it over. The people that were in the situation that I was in weren't allowed to talk about these things. Honor Flight helped me a lot.
And I'm just imagining that at the end of that sentimental journey, when you got back to Harry Reid Airport here in Las Vegas, maybe your wife of 58 years was one of the people waiting for you?
It was packed. You know, it wasn't just when you got off the airplane. I don't know how they get everybody around there to do that. But, you know, just hundreds of people. But then once you get through security, it was lined with people on both sides, all the way through the airport, cheering. And, you know, and I saw people I knew and people from my veterans club. And you get around and they have signs with your names on it, people you've never seen before. And, well, something happens on the way home that's a secret on Honor Flight. And I'm not going to...
It's okay. Our listeners have heard about mail call. You can talk about it.
It's mail call. Yeah. When I got home, I tried to answer every one of those mail calls that had an address on it. I've talked to some of the people. Matter of fact, I even got some of them to speak at our veterans club because of what they do. And it's, you know, it's amazing. I had 140-some letters in my mail call bag. My grandkids said, I mean, how did they get hold of my grandkids to send these? You know, it was just amazing, amazing. Whoever thought of Honor Flight, and I know a lot of the people here that are on the board of directors, and I knew them before I knew they were on Honor Flight. It's just amazing what they do. It's amazing the donations that handle all that. They fly 35 veterans to Washington, D.C. for the weekend, and every one of them has a chaperone, and they pay their own way. It becomes a community. Everybody that's been on an honor flight is in that community. And then a few weeks afterwards, we had an honor flight party where everybody was on the flight, both the, you know, the chaperones and the people that are part of honor flight and families. And it's amazing. They do a book. You have a book with all the pictures, hundreds of pictures. You see all the people you were on honor flight with and you exchange things. The guy that walked the reef to the Vietnam Memorial with me, he and I have been in contact now, and, you know, I'd never knew him before, and it's a camaraderie. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a gift that keeps on giving, and I think you painted a real powerful picture of that. There are still some veterans who have all kinds of reasons
not to go. Often they don't think they deserve it. Somebody else did more, or they don't want to leave their wife for a couple of days. But I think a few people's hearts are going to be stirred after hearing that. And I'm sure people's eyes are going to be opened when they read your book. And I don't want to leave that out. There's got to be something you hope people get when they read the book. What do you hope people take away if they go through all those pages? Is there a thought, a realization, an understanding you hope they take away from it?
You know, if I'd have written it 50 years ago, I would have wanted people to know what the hell we went through. Mm-hmm. Today, most of those people aren't here. Today, the people that are here don't know of Jane Fonda coming to town after she'd been to Vietnam, to North Vietnam, sitting on a tank. They don't understand that people have, you know, what was going on. Even during the war, Americans, I mean, they left the country. They changed their religion. And then you had Elvis Presley, who was probably the best-known celebrity of all time in the 50s. When they called him, he was first in line to go. What's the difference between him? Probably one of the best-known celebrities of all time. You look at the World War II celebrities. I mean, you know, sports people, Ronald Reagan, you know, they all joined. Well, I think one of the most decorated was Ernest Borgnine. Uh-huh. I mean, there's decorated people that were in the movies, and they quit to go fight.
Jimmy Stewart was bombing Germany.
Ends up being a general. I mean, he a great general, great, and made a great movie, Strategic Air Command, that you know, brought some of that to life. Yeah, but there's just, I mean, there's just gobs of those people out there. I'm proud to have served with those people.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, how Greg Schiffbauer got connected to a man who would become known as the Great Communicator, and how Greg helped influence a very well-known domestic initiative during the Ronald Reagan presidency. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up our two-part conversation with Greg Schiffbauer, who carried out secret duty with Mac V. SOG during the Vietnam War. His book is available at Amazon.com, and we have it linked for you at HometownHeroesRadio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Again, the title is First Shot. There's one thing I don't want to forget to say. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for sharing some of this, and I hope, again, people will read the book. But I also can't leave out something else, because you just mentioned Ronald Reagan, and I have interviewed folks who actually served with him in World War II. He was in San Francisco at the time. But you got to know him in a different way. You helped on his first presidential campaign when he won in 1980?
Well, It was funny. We had a very close friend named Phil Crane, who was a congressman. I think he served 17 terms in Congress from Illinois. And in 1975, he asked my wife and I if we'd want to go to Chicago and meet Ronald Reagan.
Sure.
You know, why not? Maggie's parents owned a General Electric appliance store, and Ron Reagan did a lot for the General Electric Company when he did. Traveled around the country and went to... So we went and met him, and our good friend Phil took me aside, and he said, Governor's going to ask you something. Before he asks you, he would kind of like to know the answer. And I said, okay, what's he going to ask me? And he said, well, he's looking for somebody to do advance person for him in Illinois for your district and head it up. And I said, well, let's meet him. And Maggie and I fell in love with him. I mean, could have been 5 minutes, 10 minutes talking. We fell in love with him. And he asked me if I would be his congressional coordinator in Illinois. And I said, yeah. And so over the next, that was... the day before Thanksgiving, by Christmas time, I had set up a committee of people. I had gotten delegates that would run for, it'd be his delegate at the convention. I called him up and said, not Reagan, but Phil, and I said, I'd like to get him to Illinois, have him come here to Bloomington, Illinois, and meet my friends and stuff. They worked it out. So one of his first campaign trips in January, I believe it was, of 86, he came to Bloomington, Illinois. We met him at the airport. He came in with Dave Fisher was with him, who was his kind of his advance guy. And, you know, all the Secret Service were there when we were setting it up, and we all got our little pins and stuff like that. The event went well. We had Ronald Reagan in a barn, a machine shed, talking from a combine to people about running and what he was going to do. His magnetism is unbelievable. If you meet him, you're in love with him. We worked awfully hard. I mean, we were all over. And I traveled with, when he would come to town or come to the state, I was just all over doing things for him, trying to get people there and stuff. And we were running a tough time because we were running against Jerry Ford. Jerry Ford was a wonderful person. And it was just fun, though. And then we went to the convention in Detroit. It was funny. At the briefing at the Secret Service office, the agent in charge said, he said, I've got good news and bad news for you about the convention being in Detroit. He said, all the hotels you're staying at are within walking distance to Cobalt Hall. The bad news is nobody's made it. So, you know, what are we... Well, it turned out great. It was a great convention. We stayed at the Renaissance Center, which was right along the wharf, just right down from Cobalt Hall. We had a wonderful time there, met a lot of neat people and stuff. After it was over, I was talking to the Reagans, and I said, you know something, you have done something to really ignite the Republican Party. You didn't win, but you ignited them. And he said, it wasn't me. He said it was a friend of mine. And he took this pin out, and it was a pin of a gold elephant with the black rim glasses that Barry Goldwater. He said, here's the guy that has started this. And so during the time between 76 and 80, Dave Fisher, who was sort of the advance person for Reagan, or Mike Deaver, would call me up and say, Ronald Reagan's going to be in Illinois. Would you mind doing this or would you mind doing that? And I said, oh, I'd be happy to, but I've got a request. I said, I'm on our downtown council, the Association of Commerce and Industry, and at our annual meeting, I'd like Ronald Reagan to speak. Well, that went together. Well, that started the whole thing for us. And then I, you know, every time they were around, they'd call me up and ask me if I could advance him. And then in October of 79, October 79, Dave Fisher called me and asked me if I would set up an advance meeting in Chicago for all the advance people that were going to be working the 80 campaign. And I said, of course, you know, I could do that. So we set it up and everybody came to Chicago, and then we, you know, started seeing what we were going to be doing. And when I was available, and I tried to make myself as available as much as I could to do advance work, because Nancy really liked me. we had a situation where we were in Bloomington, Illinois, which is our hometown, and Nancy was coming to speak to a group, and she brought Carol McCain with her. Carol McCain was John McCain's first wife, who was badly injured and became invalid, basically. As you probably know, when he came home from Vietnam, he left her and married some other woman. So Carol treated her like she was a sister of hers. I mean, anything she needed or so. We got to the airport, and we couldn't, it was in a private plane, and we couldn't get the steps all the way down. And Carol couldn't get it, so I picked her up and carried her into the plane. And Mrs. R. got scared because she was afraid something was wrong with the plane. She said, "Will you go with me?" And I said, "I can't." I said, "There's somebody meeting you where you're going, but I can't go with you." And we put her in the she's looking out the window like this at me like, "Why can't you?" And but it was a great event. I mean, we raised money. We had a lot of people there. You know, it just became like part of the family. Every time I did something for him, he would write me a letter. He would call me and say, "Thank you." They asked me to advance George Bush a couple times after they announced at the, you know, at the convention that he would be the running mate. He was wonderful to me. I mean, he would make sure that I was comfortable, that, you know, sent me a wonderful letter along with saying that he can't wait to see me at the inauguration after the, you know, they won and stuff like that. You know, it just became a real interesting thing. I did not go to the inauguration. I was afraid we would go and just be sitting there. Well, I found out Dave Fisher, everybody said, "You know, why didn't you come?" I said, "Well, he didn't, you know." She said, "We had parties. All we went to, you know, we all did." I said, "I didn't need the parties." But, you know, and then after he became president, they would call me up quite a bit and ask me to help on advance. And I even took Maggie to Connecticut and New York. You know, I mean, it was my expense, of course. But it was great. We went to the Union Club in New York, and Claire Booth Luce was the host. She hosted Nancy Reagan. That club was so neat. That's where all the Union soldiers would go to New York that were the officers. That's where they did their R&R, and the walls were covered with these portraits of them, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful place. We just had a wonderful time. And after I stopped doing advance work and stuff like that, had a call from a friend of mine that knew I had done that, and he said he had a friend that wanted to go out there and start a program, and it was Dave Winfield, the baseball player. Mm-hmm. Dave Winfield took at home games on Saturday, and I hope I have this all right, this is the way to explain it, would take like 35 kids, pay for their way, they would have a luncheon, then he would talk to them about values and doing the right things and stuff like that, and then he would take them all to the ball games. Well, he wanted to do something for Reagan and to support. And so a friend of his talked to me and said, "Can you get us in, you know, to talk to somebody?" And he wanted to talk to Meese, who was the Attorney General. I said, "Well, let me try." Well, got a hold of him. Said Dave Winfield would like to come out and meet and set up some type of a thing to a patriotic thing. And we were talking about it. Well, that became the Just Say No campaign on drugs. Mm-hmm. Just Say No to Drugs. And Ed Meese was the Attorney General at the time. And he said, "Well, we need somebody from the White House." And I'm trying to think, you know, who are we going to get from the White House? And I said, "Maybe we can get Mrs. R." And, "You think so?" I said, "I don't know." Well, called up over there and talked to Carol McCain, John McCain's ex. And she said, "Well, she's not here right now, but let me talk to her and we'll get back with you." Well, she ended up being it. And that was the Just Say No campaign that was put together by the principals were Nancy Reagan, Dave Winfield, the Attorney General, Ed Meese, and there was a White House guy there that was part of the medical or something like that. And that's what set up the Just Say No campaign.
So it was your idea for Nancy Reagan to be the spokesperson for that?
To be a figurehead. Dave Winfield was really the spokesperson. This was all Dave Winfield's idea. You know, he was quite a baseball player.
And basketball and football.
He was drafted by all three major sports. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I've got a wonderful picture in my house that he signed. And he just signed it a couple years ago.
Oh, wow.
Somebody got it to him. Yeah.
Well, if there's anything I didn't ask you about, feel free to share. But I just wonder, too, because I was struck, I don't know if it was a year or two ago, somebody sent me a video. It was Tom Brokaw interviewing President Reagan. And they wanted me to watch it because Reagan talked about his sports casting days, and that's my profession.
Yeah.
But I was just struck at again, what an incredible communicator he was. And we've had presidents since then, and maybe the standard of communication has changed. Are there days where you say, hey, I wonder what President Reagan would say about this? Or there's something maybe you think our political discourse today could learn from the way he handled things?
Well, he was the great communicator. I've watched him defuse many things. He just, you know, the one thing that can stand out was in the debate with it, where he just said, you know, you were about him being his junior. and you know, he was just able and to say it without harming anybody. You know, he didn't call them idiots. He just said, well, you know, what I understand is this and that and this and that. And he did that throughout the world. I mean, I never sat in with him when he talked to Gorbachev or somebody like that. But I've been to sat on a plane with him. I've sat in a helicopter with him. And just his demeanor is just, he's just himself. He was just amazing. I have a picture of all three of our kids. Our youngest son was born on the same date as Ronald Reagan. So that was quite a picture. And it happened in the year our son was born, in 1979. And it happened in Illinois. He came to speak to a dinner, the one that I told you I wanted him to come to. And here is the future president of the United States, you know, with our three kids. And one of them had the same birthday. It's kind of neat. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I appreciate your time. There's just not enough you can say about the young men that go to war to protect our freedom. I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about 18, 17, 18, 19-year-old kids. It's just, it's amazing. I don't know if the draft will ever come back. My wife is so happy that our boys never were in the military. I think they'd have learned a lot from it, but I wouldn't have wanted them to be in harm's way either. So, you know, war has gotten so mechanized and so artificial. You know, we might not need soldiers much longer. We've got robots that do things that we did. The planes fly themselves. The helicopters fly themselves. Hopefully, and as I said, and I usually do the prayers at church on Veterans Day and Memorial Day, and I just remember that, just saying that we pray that this war is the last war that we ever have, and our men will no longer stand in the line of fire. And we hope that's true.
Well, and in light of that, I do have one more question. Because you shared, you know, some of what you could about what you did in Southeast Asia, and I hope people will get the book First Shot and read more about it. But are there moments that you look back on where you feel that God was looking out for you, that your life was spared when it didn't have to be?
Oh, absolutely. Man, no, that's, and you don't have to be at war for that. You'd be crossing a street. But yeah, absolutely. I feel that there's been people watching over me my whole life.
Greg Schiffbauer, author of the book First Shot. Thanks again to Honor Flight Southern Nevada. And thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, inviting you to join us again next time when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.